Yeah, my name is Roel Snieder, and what teaching with heart means to me is to help teachers in higher education, in particular in technical fields in higher education, to bring an atmosphere of care into the classroom.
Welcome to SEG Seismic Sound Off, conversations addressing the challenges of energy, water, and climate. I'm your host, Andrew Gary. In this episode, Dr. Roel Snieder discusses how to excel as a teacher and professional using the Teaching with Heart practices. Roel makes the case for creating a more nurturing and loving educational environment. He challenges the notion that teaching to outcomes is the sole purpose of education, advocating for a balance between achieving academic goals and fostering student growth. You will hear how meditative techniques, introspection, and awareness of one's beliefs can significantly influence the teaching dynamic. Throughout the episode, Roel addresses the potential pitfalls of ego in teaching, the importance of seeing students as individuals with unique challenges and aspirations, and the delicate balance of maintaining professional boundaries while cultivating meaningful relationships. This episode is not just for educators. It's a reminder that the learning journey, which never ends, is enriched when both teachers and students show up as whole, interconnected individuals. Please check out the show notes for all the valuable links referenced in this conversation. I especially encourage you to check out the rest of the staff connected to the Teaching with Heart practices that works with my guest today. And now, here is my conversation with Roel Snieder. Well, it's an honor to speak with you about Teaching with Heart. And we're going to start with a basic so people can kind of get on the same page here. What is the Teaching with Heart project?
Well, it's a project that we have started to help teachers in higher education to create a more caring, or I might even say a more loving classroom environment. We tend to see teaching as in technical fields, in mathematics and physics and geophysics, as sort of a clinical and heartless activity aimed at bringing students to certain outcomes. But I think it is really important that we do that. This is an important thing to do, that we do that with a level of care, or I might even say with a level of love in the classroom.
Do you think you talk about these outcomes that teachers are frequently required to kind of reach. Do you think in high school, at least in the United States, I think a lot of teaching to outcomes is a very common idea. Do you feel like in higher education, there are those same requirements for teachers where they feel like they are just needing to teach to outcomes to keep their job going?
Yes, we absolutely are outcome focused. And it's not just to keep your job going. I think if you want to teach well, you need to articulate outcomes for your class. You need to it's basically defining a target of where you want your students to be at the end of the class. So good teaching is focused on outcomes, and also assessment is not so much used to grade and evaluate the students, but to give you, as a teacher, and also the students feedback on where they are in relation to the outcomes that you'd like them to reach. So there's nothing wrong with teaching to outcomes. I think there's something wrong with only teaching to outcomes. That's more of the issue.
Yeah, it's kind of important. You need to know where you're going. That's a good way to put that. You know, one of the things you talk about is encouraging other teachers to remember when they themselves were students. When you yourself reflect on your time as a student, what are one or two things that you try to hold on to now as someone that's a teacher and an advisor?
Well, first of all, I want to say I've been blessed with wonderful teachers and advisors. But the thing that really stands out for me, for the teachers that I remember, were teachers that did two things. They would empower me. And the other thing is they sort of had an infectious enthusiasm. And that has been both things have been very important to me.
You know, while reading about the Teaching with Heart project, I came across some unique phrases and tools. Growing a character of love was mentioned, employing meditative techniques, developing an awareness of one's own beliefs. Why do you think these belong in the conversation for teachers?
Yeah, well, thank you for asking that. And that really brings us to the core of our project. When I started teaching at universities, I got basically no training. Basically, I was said, okay, this is your course. Have a nice life. I must say the Colorado School of Mines has done a great job in teacher trainings. But I think traditional teacher training focuses on two aspects. It focuses on course design and on pedagogy, and both are really important. So course design has to do with formulating outcomes, then designing your course so you actually get to reach those outcomes, and also setting up the assessments so that you can validate. And then pedagogy is how do you do that in the classroom? Those are very important things. You know, I mean, I'm not arguing that those are not important, but I think there's a third element missing, and that is what is the character that you bring into the classroom as a teacher. How do you see your students? How do you see your role as a teacher? And most programs for teacher preparation, especially in higher education, don't discuss these issues. And the beliefs that you have about yourself, the beliefs that you have about your students affect the way you show up in the classroom. And I want to add to that teaching is sort of can be a dangerous activity. It can be a very ego-gratifying activity because you are the expert in front of students who cannot go anywhere. And not only are you the experts who are lecturing to them and you know much more about the topic than they do, but you also have to hold the power over their grade and over their progress. So if you're sensitive to it, it could be a very ego-gratifying experience that might not serve the students. I'm not saying that always happens. You know, fortunately, for most teachers, it doesn't happen. But that's why we, in our Teaching with Heart program, we go back to help teachers evaluate what really their role is in the classroom. How do they want to show up in the classroom? How do they see their role? How do they see the students? And so that involves reflection and introspection.
So, you know, you have this classroom component, but, where ego could certainly seep in, I think people can understand that. But then you also have an advisor-student relationship where ego could also play a role, maybe even a more of a role in that kind of dynamic. What are some common issues you see arise within the advisor-student relationship?
Well, I mean, I first want to say many times it works absolutely beautiful and it's sort of a harmonious work relation that benefits everybody, but not always. I think one of the biggest frictions that can occur is that academic advisors, they worked very hard to bring in research grants. Then they have to deliver for those grants. They have, you know, every grant comes with deliverables. They also are under pressure for their own scientific productivity, and that's especially true for younger tenure track faculty. So they want to produce. They want to produce research results, which is completely understandable because that's the core business of what we do as researchers. That can sometimes put graduate students under a lot of pressure. And that pressure can be like a moral pressure. It can even be downright exploitation. I'm not saying that always happens, but I think that is a major issue. And of course, the system sort of enforces that in teachers in the sense that, or in advisors, those advisors are under pressure to produce research quickly and to produce a lot of research.
So with this pressure to progress on a research front being a main deliverable for a lot of students and even advisors as well, how do you help them reprioritize and focus on student growth as well as a huge thing that they should be driving towards?
First of all, the student is there to grow. The student is there to learn. Right? If you have a master's or a PhD student coming in and they knew everything already, you'd give them their degree when they enter. And it's because they go to school to learn. So they must get the opportunities to learn. And sometimes learning occurs best by doing things wrong, by trial and error. That is one thing. So you must have a little patience with your students. But I think it's also in the long-term interest of the advisors that the students grow. So you can focus on, you know, the research productivity of this month and not give students the opportunities to grow and not giving them, spend the time with them that they need to learn the skills that they need to know to become sort of mature researchers. I think in the long run, certainly over the time of a PhD project, it actually pays off if you spend the time with the students to give them the opportunity to grow. The other thing is, okay, in research you have to work hard. I mean, we know that. But that working harder doesn't always mean that the research goes better. I think sort of a healthy dose of self-care is important for our own well-being, but it's also important for our research. If I get stuck on my research, I go for a run. I solve a lot of the problems that I'm running, and I'm not saying that running is for everybody, for every researcher, the right way to get unstuck, but to be aware of what are activities that help you get unstuck, What are the activities that help you tap into your creativity? It's important to know that. That takes some trial and error to figure out what those are. And those activities also take time. But they're very important for our research progress. At least in my experience, they are.
You know, things like grades, published papers, those are pretty easy things to track, you know, metric wise. It's pretty easy to look at and see the grade you got, see where you got a paper published. But student growth or just growth even as a teacher could be a little harder to track. What are some ways that you try to communicate with the students of how far they're progressing and being able to track that yourself and among the students?
Yeah, so this is of course different for undergraduates or students that you might teach in a class and for students with whom you do research. For teaching in a class, I think if you'd see their growth to be reflected in the maturity of their responses and in the but also in the learning outcomes. To what degree do they reach the learning outcomes? With graduate students, it's less tangible, and I think it depends what you want, what you're looking for at an advisor. I'm a big fan of Stephen Covey, and he introduced the concept of interdependence. So I hear many advisors say that they want to guide certainly their PhD students to independence. I think that is sort of a narrow way to look at it. Independence is where you basically can live on your own and you don't need others, right? That is independence. Interdependence includes that attitude, but also knowing that you are part of a network. Knowing that being part of that network is a game of give and take. And I think we need interdependence to be good researchers. So what I'm looking for with graduate students is that sign of interdependence. And the first signs of that growth is when they start to push back against me. It's very normal for a graduate student who comes in, who starts working in a new field, who is insecure, that they are in a state of dependence. They're looking to the advisor, okay, what do I do next? But really in the PhD, and more so than in the master's degree, you want students to grow beyond that. And the first step beyond that is to start pushing back against the advisor. So I'm waiting for that moment when I suggest something to a graduate student and they tell me, you know, I'd like to try something different. I love it when that happens.
One of the other practices listed for teachers is to show up as a whole person. And there's an image that a teacher, Sarah Susan Reynolds, that she shares with her class, sort of her strengths and her challenges as a teacher. And one of those challenges is thinks of students as friends. And reading over these practices, I could see a lot of difficulty navigating these practices without thinking of students as friends. How do you understand that supposed challenge within the greater context of these practices? Or maybe is that kind of specific to some teachers over others?
No, I think it's a great point. I mean, first of all, it can be a bit tricky seeing students as friends. I mean, first of all, relations should be appropriate. We speak to our teachers about love in the classroom. That obviously does not include romantic love. Well, we need to be very clear about it. But also in terms of friendships, there are, of course, different styles in which you can work with as advisors with students. And you're also in a hierarchical relation. And you are also in the role of the evaluator, which sometimes a friendship can interfere with that role. I think I sort of navigate it by spending some time with students outside of the normal advisor-student relation. I think it's really helpful. But there are, of course, some pitfalls to let the friendship that becomes too close cloud your judgment. And also you need to be careful with favoritism. So Susan Reynolds, who I really admire, and I love the way she shows up to her students. She's talking about friendship. I see it more like seeing the whole person. So that means in particular with either students in the classroom or graduate students that you work with is to see who they are, to be open to their dreams, to their insecurities, to the hurdles that they face, to their hopes. Become aware of them and sort of work with them in the growth in navigating these waters. That's what I mean with seeing the whole person. And that avoids some of the pitfalls that there may be in friendships that might get too close or that might interfere with the role that we have as evaluator.
in coming up with these practices and trying to implement them yourselves and working with other teachers on these practices, do you kind of find some common roadblocks in getting teachers to kind of adapt these practices, given, you know, especially their training probably doesn't talk anything about what a lot of these practices are getting at?
Well, first of all, is that many teachers confuse caring for students with pampering students. And this is why the reflection, you asked me earlier to think back about the teachers that I've had. One exercise I love doing with teachers is I make them think about a teacher that has a positive impact on them. First of all, I haven't encountered a single person yet who cannot think of such a teacher, which is wonderful. And then I always ask them, did the teacher pamper you? And the answer I always get is no, this teacher challenged me. So bringing care to the classroom or even bringing love to the classroom doesn't necessarily mean pampering. You still set boundaries. You may love your children, but you don't allow them to build a fire in the living room. So that is one thing. The other one is that, and we see this mostly with the younger teachers in our cohorts, the tenure track teachers, they feel that if they are too caring for students, it may hurt their tenure evaluation, which I find amazing. That doesn't mean that it actually does hurt their tenure evaluation, but they are afraid it will hurt their tenure process. I don't think that's what most universities intend, but that is a perception among faculty. And I don't think that's what universities are looking for, actually. And the third barrier that we see is that teachers say, well, I have no time. I'm so busy. There are some practices that take virtually no time. There are some practices that do take time, but there are some ways to bring care to the classroom that almost take no time. For example, you know, students, it really helps students if you learn their name and if you are aware of the pronouns they prefer. So I give students name tents and I ask them, you know, put your name on there. If you have a preferred pronoun, I'd love it if you put it on there. And then the moments when students are working or something, I just look at the students and I look at their name tents and I memorize their name. It takes literally no extra time other than the organization to bring some name tents to the classroom. And we've made a list of teaching with heart practices, and some of them take time and significant practice and habituation. Others take virtually no time. It's a matter of attitude. It's a matter of heart.
Yeah, and the website lays out a very helpful, which will be linked in the show notes of this episode, but does a great job of these are the things that are almost no time at all, like the name tags is listed there, and then it goes up on two other levels of time involved. But like you said, some of them are simply a mindset shift more than something you're having to do. You know, you mentioned Stephen Covey's book. You yourself co-wrote a book kind of talking about a lot of these principles, but were there other resources, other books, other teachers that really got you on this path and thinking differently about teaching?
Oh, well, I've had amazing people in my life, people that made me reflect on who I am and what I do and why I do the things that I do. It's very easy to sort of get in a rut and to move forward. You know, one of those people is actually one of my co-workers in Teaching with Heart, is Cynthia James. She has been very formative and she has been guiding me through a lot of introspection and reflection, not only as a one-time process, but also as a continuous process, you know, giving me tools to basically reflect on how do I want to show up.
Would you recommend someone, you know, a teacher or advisor listening to this and intrigued by it, what do you think is the next step for them? And would you encourage them to try to do this with a partner? Do you find it easier if they join up with another teacher as well as they go about navigating these practices?
Absolutely, because it takes a certain courage to step out of the ordinary mold and to show up. Show your care to students. There's a certain vulnerability involved, and that can be a showstopper in practice. And so to be supported by others, I think, is really important. For one thing, we're going to start another cohort of teachers in the summer of 2024, after the beginning of the fall semester. And on the Teaching with Heart website, teachers can sign up to be part of that cohort, and we create an online community. We offer workshops that allows teachers to go through our program as a group. We also have a newsletter now that we issue, and every newsletter has a It's a bi-weekly newsletter. It's it makes us think about how do we want to teach. And it also, we make sure in every newsletter we put in some discussion questions so that you can get together with a group of teachers at your own institution and discuss these things. So that's an easy thing that teachers could do, is to follow that newsletter. And if there's a topic that appeals to them, you know, get a group of colleagues together, or maybe even have a faculty meeting if a department would be so bold to do that and talk about this. And I think it's important, because if you step out of the normal mode of operation, it takes courage. And to be supported by others, I think, is really helpful.
If you could share with the teacher advisor one action to take to start improving their student relationships, what would it be and why?
Look and listen carefully. And, you know, the most important thing of listening is to just be silent. So, you know, learn about them. Learn about their hopes, their dreams, their personal situation. Many of the graduate students in the United States, they're from abroad. They are far away from their support network. They have grown up in a different cultural system. Sometimes they are with a spouse who cannot work and who has no health insurance. They may have parents who are ill and who are abroad. You know, just listen to them. What is easy for them? What is hard for them? And look carefully. I think that's the most important thing. Seeing and hearing the other person. And one thing that it does is that we all want to be heard and seen. That I think that's a deep desire in many of us. So taking the time to basically look and listen is one of the greatest gifts you can give somebody.
Mm. What has been your greatest discovery teaching with these practices in mind?
Well, first of all, my greatest discovery is to learn how much some students have on their plate.
Mm.
You may be in front of a group of students and there's so much going on in their lives that you are oblivious of. Once students start to trust you, they open up and you learn more about them. You learn more about their challenges. And that actually helps you to support them better. One thing I sometimes do in classes, I give them an index card and I tell them, I say, you know, I'm teaching you, but there's a lot I don't know about you. So if you have anything you want to share with me or any challenge, and you're willing to share it with me anonymously, put it on the card. You may hand in the card empty. You may say, I'm doing fine. What I typically find is that one third of the students is doing fine. One third of the students have what I call the normal stressors of being a college student. I have to learn a new programming language and it gives me stress. Okay, I get it. That's part of going to college and doing things. And then one third of the students comes up with challenges that I never had imagined. You know, I have a drinking problem. I work at night at DHL at Denver Airport to pay for my tuition. My mother is psychiatric and I'm the only person who can take care of her. I mean, things like that.
What challenge would you like to leave the listener from this conversation?
I think the challenge is to really, really bring your heart into the classroom. Show up as a person, show up with care, not in the sense of pampering them, but in the sense of being open to really see them as a person, be a whole person for the students as well, and bring that into your teaching relation.
Before the last question, is there anything I should have asked you that I did not?
Yeah, there is actually one thing we talk about is love in the classroom. And actually our work is being supported by the Templeton Foundation. And part of our project is also to find out what is an appropriate language, a language that teachers and advisors in science and engineering can relate to. And what we found, there's an amazing book, it's called Love as a Business Strategy. And it's written by four men who worked for Softway. And the book is about how do you bring love in a business environment, where I think also in the field of geophysics, people might say, well, wait a minute, is that our core business? But what if our organizations would work better by doing that? And what they do in their book is they make the whole concept of love, which is sort of fuzzy and intangible, operational, by breaking it down into six, I call it six pillars, and these are inclusion, empathy, vulnerability, trust, empowerment, and forgiveness. And in their book, they discuss how you can bring that into a business environment and how the business environment might actually benefit from from doing it.
Well, we will link to that book. That's a great wrap up and summary of all the things we're talking about here. And lastly, to close, Roel, if you had to describe your journey in one word, what would it be and why?
Well, my journey has been a journey from being very much focused on research and research productivity. And what I've done as part of the journey is really ask myself the question, why do I do it and who benefits from my work? And then I started reflecting on who benefited from my work. And it was mostly, I think, in the personal interactions with other people that they benefited from working with me. Now, maybe that's delusional. You know, I don't know. Maybe my self-image is overblown. But at one point, I think I came to the conclusion I had a bit bigger impact with the interactions with other people on my work than with the content of my research.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Seismic Sound Off. SEG creates these episodes to celebrate and inspire the geophysicists of today and tomorrow. Visit seg.org to learn more. Email the show at podcast@seg.org. This episode was hosted, edited, and produced by me, Andrew Gary, at TreasureMint. The SEG podcast team is Jennifer Cobb, Kathy Gamble, and Allie McGinnis. The podcast will return next week with a new episode. Until then, this is Seismic Sound Off, signaling off.